And I feel that we're in a, really in a catch-up. This is a place where we have a great deal to learn from the third world, from Asia, from Latin America. My God, they've been fighting this on the front lines. And our corporations have been coming in and taking their minerals and their water and their privatizing their transportation and energy and everything for a long time. And if anything, we have the learning curve is the other way. We have a great deal to learn. That's why it's very important to listen to the voices from the Global South on the panels here, because they'll tell a different story. Their dad does know. Their kids are talking about it. They probably don't have a playground, but they are talking about it. They do know. And that's the great gap between the first world and the third world realities.
Yeah, the problem is here. That's Martin Kaur likes to say, the pathology is in the north. It's you know, the problem is getting it out here. Do you want to add something, David?
Okay. Yeah, I think, you know, as I noted last night, I do think we have seen an enormous shift in the country, that there are far fewer credible voices who are still challenging the basic issue of whether climate change is a problem. I think that's a huge breakthrough. But what we're in right now is a phase where the establishment is very focused on, okay, how can we take this concern and turn it into a new profit opportunity? And I think part of what we see our role here is trying to take the discussion beyond that any solutions that can be done within the kind of private profit orientation are positive steps in the right direction. But I think most of us feel that cannot be the total solution, because ultimately we've got to look at much deeper changes. Now that, of course, is a very long and complicated conversation, because it is about reinventing ourselves and reinventing our societies. Now, there's been kind of a tendency in these questions, it's a sort of a sense of what are you going to do about it? And the real question is, what are we going to do about it? And how do we carry this conversation forward? And my hope is, out of things like our conference here, that we're providing tools for everybody who's participating to help carry forward that conversation. And it is, you know, the first step is the conversation. We can't get any place without that.
Simon? Can I just add to on your point about communicating? I think it's an important area. We have to be, all of us who are engaged in this issue, very sensitive to how people in different types of constituencies react to different types of language. We have to be better, much better, at using the type of language with different groups that they are comfortable with, not the ones we're necessarily comfortable with. And I know of groups in the US that have spent a lot of time working with their own constituencies, whether it's in churches, whether it's with farmers, whether it's with people working in the tourist sector, for example, and talking to them about how this issue will impact what they care about.
Sir?
Would anybody like to talk for a moment to try to enlighten me a little further about the nature of corporations? The little I understand is that sometime in the 19th century, corporations became recognized as people, as individuals, with, for example, the rights of free expression, which they now exercise by flooding the media.
David?
Yeah. Well, you're asking a very big question, and part of the issue starts with, you know, technically the term corporation means any kind of group of people that are organized together and have a recognized ability to enter into contracts and act as a person. In that sense, a corporation is kind of essential to modern life. But our concerns are with the for-profit corporations. The biggest structural problem is specifically with the publicly traded corporations, where the ownership filters through financial markets and public trading, which means that most of the owners in the end have no idea what companies they own, what they're doing. The only thing they know is how much financial return they're getting, and this creates a terribly destructive dynamic of forcing the most powerful institutions in our society to focus only on the immediate financial bottom line. Now, some people, I've focused much of my critique on the publicly traded corporation. Increasingly, people are saying, and I think quite correctly, that, you know, many of the privately held, which means corporations whose shares are not traded in the public markets, can in fact be even more pernicious than the publicly traded companies, because they are less regulated and less transparent. And particularly as we get into private equity companies, which are in the business of buying and selling the biggest corporations for a quick buck, you know, we really need to reframe that argument about public versus private. But, you know, then you clearly get into the set of issues around around how big can a corporation be. And my basic view, you know, I tend to be kind of a libertarian in some sense, that, you know, I have an honest libertarian in the sense of distrusting any great concentration of unaccountable power. And so, you know, I think ownership issues are very key, that the corporations should be owned, should it be accountable to people who have some direct connection to that corporation. They live in the community it operates in, they work in it, they're customers of it, so there is a human relationship in addition to the financial. But I think there also need to be strict limits on size. So that, those are some of the key arguments.
Let me just answer quickly, and then I know Maud wants to say something. The distinction between public and private is, I think, very, very important. It's true that a private corporation has less regulation, but a private corporation has the option, it has the possibility of doing the right thing, whereas a public corporation basically does not. A public corporation is following a set of rules that are determined by banks, investors, the rules of shareholder responsibility, so that if a public corporation like Exxon or Union Carbide, which recently did horrendous, monstrous things to the environment, to the people, to the indigenous people of those regions, those corporations cannot agree to do the right thing in terms of compensation, because then their boards of directors and their shareholders rise up and say, profit is what matters. Basically, a publicly held corporation has to answer only to growth and profit to satisfy investors. If I own a corporation personally, I may be just as terrible, but I don't have to be. There's nobody above me. I can say I'll do the right thing. And so you do get some private corporations who make that choice, and it's a very, very important distinction. So the rules of corporate form are very crucial, and those can be changed. The humanization, the corporations as the personhood of corporations is one of the most monstrous legal steps quite recently imposed that has ever been taken. It's probably caused a whole lot of the problems that the world faces right now, because it gives corporations the ability and rights of individual human beings and the ability to free speech, and therefore can rule in a way that they hadn't before. So it is an important reform. And incidentally, that reform was driven by the American Civil Liberties Union, which I'm a member of, and they did a lot of the legal cases to give corporations the same rights of speech as human beings. And the guy who ran that case has been sorry ever since, but nonetheless, reversing it is no easy task.
I'd just say, perhaps as a case example, is how destructive corporations have been in the destruction of water, particularly in the third world, until fairly recently, the most water systems in the global north, and still are, run publicly by governments or government agencies on a nonprofit basis. But it became clear that there was going to be money to be made with the infusions of aid and development funds from the World Bank and the other development banks in the late 1980s, and organized campaign took place to gather a consensus by the World Bank and others, and these big corporations that were European at the time, mostly French, who for different reasons had got a foothold in France. They decided they could expand and become global, and they could deliver water on a for-profit basis in the third world. And I actually remember talking to some politicians in France who said, this is Germany, and this politician, and I said, well, most of the European water systems are public. Why are you promoting privatization in the third world? And he said, because we are good enough to have a public system. You know, we're smart enough. We know how to do it. But in the third world, they don't know how to do it. So we're exporting our corporations to deliver water to them. And it was a very deliberate campaign to gather global consensus, including within the elite leaders within the third world, to promote a private model. And now what we're fighting is the entrenchment of these corporations that have enormous power. Their governments are behind them. The World Bank is behind them. Developing country governments have no choice if they don't accept the privatization, or these big companies, and they're even told which companies to accept. They don't get the aid money. And the most tragic thing of all, since this privatization experiment happened, is that total aid and total money for development of water projects at the very time when the need was exploding has actually declined in the last decade. Because the banks and the northern development agencies assumed that these private companies were going to move in and take over where they were able to pull their money out because there would be this massive investment. Well, there was no massive investment. There's been a total disinvestment, and it's a crime. It's a crime against humanity. It's a crime against the future. And I stood on a bank in Bolivia, just outside of La Paz, where one of the companies, Suez, had promised to bring in wastewater treatment, and they didn't. They just cut a bunch of gullies, and they just were pouring the garbage in the sewage. And I stood downstream from an abattoir where the carcasses and the blood were coming through communities where people live, being dumped directly into Lake Titicaca, which is a World Heritage Site, not for long, I can assure you. And there was a film crew there, and I said, you know, I've been saying that these Suez was a theft, with theft of people's rights. I said, this is murder. He said, would you like to reframe that? And I said, if you can think of a stronger word, I'll use it. But, you know, right now I'm sticking to murder. This is a crime against humanity, what's happening here. And these corporations have been at the forefront of it, backed by the powerful institutions. And what Anne says is exactly right. We have to understand the power of the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the other regional development banks, the aid that our governments give these corporations through these institutions to impose a system on other countries. This Washington consensus, the privatization, the least possible government, the most powerful corporations, the most free expression for corporations, deregulation, this is the name of the game. And with all respect to Republicans, under George Bush, there have been almost 500 environmental regulations cut or totally destroyed in his time. I mean, they have done terrible damage on top of not dealing with the climate change issue. They have undone many, many, many environmental structures that were put in place and have taken us back. I'm a Canadian, but we're getting real linked here, 30, 40, 50 years before a time of environmental consciousness on this continent.
I mean, there is like a consensus, right, on the impact of climate change and this and that, but I think that there's such a ridiculous filter that goes on with media systems and the like that I don't think that there's really that same kind of consensus among people, especially given that so many people get news from right-wing talk radio and the like. I also think that in terms of the greater problem, which is systemic, in terms of corporate power and the like, there's nothing. I mean, I don't think there's any discussion outside of really far out, you know, radical groups about the real dangers of corporate power and the like.
Well, without getting too long an answer here, the questions that you raise are very important. But the good news is, climate was not even anywhere in the newspapers of the United States. It's been a subject of debate in Europe for quite a while. And as Maud says, people in the third world have been experiencing it for quite a while and have no confusion about it at all. It's only in this country that it has been so little known, and that's the most important fact. But the problem of the media control is one that nobody's addressing. Nobody is efficiently addressing. And that is, you know, I mean, I could quote statistics about global media. You know, 70% of global media is owned by 8 corporations, of all global media. But the degree of control of media by a very small number of corporations who are all in agreement about it and who all have an interest in suppressing this information is very, very strong. And they're creating a worldview of commodity-driven lifestyle which produces happiness, and it's also an escape from everything that's going on in their real lives. It's a very, very important set of reforms that need to take place about that. Most importantly, that the media ought to be considered a public commons. It ought to be commonly owned. To mention the name Ralph Nader is usually a little dangerous now, but he's been talking about that for a very, very long time. And it's a movement that really has to get generated. There's one group called Free Press, led by Bob McChesney, which is doing a lot of work in terms of trying to change the rules of media control. That's a major problem. And alternative media are doing a pretty good job at trying to balance that. I myself love YouTube. I think it's terrific. But it's very, very small compared to the scale of the problem. So we have to put that on our agenda.
Let me tell a funny story.
And then we're going to go to this man because he has his hand raised.
We had, when George Bush came to Canada in August for this Three Amigos Summit for the Security Prosperity Partnership I was talking about last night, we ended up calling it the Jelly Bean Summit because they said it's really about coordinating the color and the dyes of the jelly beans across the border. So we called it the Jelly Bean Summit. But anyway, it was in Montebello, this little town in Quebec, and we had a very big protest. And a ton of police, like you can't, well, you can't, anybody's been to any of the demos, but I mean, it was just out of all proportion. I was in a coffee shop, and one of the police officers came in, and I heard it was all in French, but my French was okay enough to understand it, and somebody said, what are all these protesters doing here? And he said, oh, these three guys, the president and prime ministers are meeting, and they're talking about all sorts of really important things, and they're only talking to corporations. And these folks in the street are mad. This is what he said. Yeah. I thought, we got our message out.
Yeah.
We got it out.
The cameraman.
Are kind of the spokespeople for the rest of us out, you know, dealing with the mainstream as much as possible. And I know for a long time have felt your voices very marginalized. And I'm curious if the last few years and, you know, whatever we think of Al Gore's environmental campaign, if we could call it that, you know, what that's done for public consciousness, and if you have felt in your own lives a greater receptivity, more, you know, interviews coming to mainstream venues, if there's more willingness to hear your point of view, or if you feel still as ostracized as ever.
I see a huge amount of progress being made essentially at the local level, by states and by governors. There's now a lot of concern that the states, California, the Western Coast states, and New England states need to do something about that. I am no longer treated as a pariah when I go to the Rotary Club, when I talk about global change, because in Key Largo we know it's going to come in the form of a really nasty storm one day. And then, importantly, politically, we have to realize that we are a minority fringe. There are too few of us to ever make any difference. But one of the big groups that are out there have been the religious conservatives. And the leadership of Richard Cizik in getting the National Association of Evangelicals to speak out about environmental issues has been massive. He can mobilize 60 million people, which is probably, you know, about three orders of magnitude more than we can.
Well, why don't we all just answer this question? That's probably the wrap-up.
Good way to wrap up.
Go ahead.
Well, I haven't felt marginalized, and I don't think our voices have been marginalized. I think we've had far more success than is generally acknowledged in the media and by politicians in general. I could look at the fights that we've been involved in. We couldn't stop NAFTA, although if they'd gone to a popular referendum in any of the three countries, it would not have moved. But we did stop the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which was its next step in its tracks. I mean, Latin America has just said no to the neoliberal agenda. There's been tremendous work and collaboration there. We have collectively stopped the WTO in its tracks. It's dead at the moment, and may it rest in peace. We collectively killed the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, which was the first global investment treaty that would have given corporations the same rights in every country that they have in NAFTA under Chapter 11 to sue governments of another country if they don't like the environmental or labor laws or whatever that they've got in place. We've had some very deep successes. I know in the water movement, we put together a very powerful international water movement that has actually forced Suez to finally say, I give up. Suez has announced it's leaving Latin America. This is unbelievable. This is just like a dream come true, and we have so discredited the World Bank in its work on water that, in fact, every time they open their mouths, they're refuting our charges. They are now answering us. Globalization, in the form that it existed, is dead, and it's part of why the movement has changed and morphed. I don't think that it split us. I think that we are growing as the globalization reality changes. We don't have a globalized world when you have the empire here and the blocks that are forming. And that's the new fear, is that, you know, we go from one terrible thing to another terrible thing. But I think our global social justice movement is the most powerful and wonderful thing in the world. And I don't feel marginalized at all by it.
I agree with Maud, actually. You know, if you've been an activist as long as I have, then you've seen the stages of these kind of movements, and you see that the first thing is nobody's ever going to listen to you. Then some people start listening to you. Then you get attacked back, and then you are engaged, and then things move, and then something happens, and suddenly you make breakthroughs. In the globalization movement, we've certainly experienced that, all of those stages, and the whole institution of globalization can't survive peak oil and climate change for very long in any case. Even global corporations are probably on the way out if you want to take the long view. But, I mean, we're not at that stage yet. As far as the climate issue is concerned, I think the Al Gore movie did a lot of good in terms of waking people up to the crisis. The new movie by Leonardo DiCaprio, The 11th Hour, is also very good in terms of identifying the crisis. I think in both cases they dropped the ball on solutions. They made it seem like the solution, in the DiCaprio movie, which I'm in, you know, is going to be better technology and sort of, you know, smarter people designing high-tech systems that are going to sort of save the world. I think that's baloney myself, and I've told them that. But most of the movie, the analysis of the problem is actually quite good. Right now, the system is responding to the crisis by giving a lot of false solutions. In other words, the system is no longer denying the crisis. The system is saying, yes, there is a crisis. These are the solutions, and they're putting out a whole lot of false solutions, like biofuels, which is a really disastrous solution, clean coal, nuclear, blah, blah, blah. Green consumption is one of the big solutions. Carbon trading is another big solution. We're going to deal with all that in the next couple of hours upstairs. And it's our job now to engage in that. But now we have an argument going on about it. And we put out the first booklet that you should all have if you came in the door on biofuels. It's a pretty good report. We're going to do that other things on alternative energy systems. So I think the subject is engaged. We just have to build a community a lot more so there's a critical mass to make change happen. But that's up to all of you. You know, that's up to all of us. And it's not, and we try to construct systems and organizations and movements within our communities and movements in our neighborhoods, and then movement on a state or regional level if we possibly can, that moves things forward. But this is how things go. You know, when it's an early moment of a movement, it looks pretty tough. And it is pretty tough. But this one, we have an advantage this time, because things are going to start happening that we have nothing to do with, that are going to be very, very bad, and that will illustrate the points that we're already making. The species are already dying. The poverty and struggles that indigenous peoples face around the world are very, very related to all of the issues we're talking about. Soon that's going to visit our coastal cities, and we'll have to deal with weather situations that will make it all very clear. So momentum will build, but the main thing is for us to all get as educated as we can, to get acquainted with the details of the pros and cons of these arguments, and then to organize wherever we are as best we can.
On Al Gore, absolutely, no doubt. He's made a difference. We tend to think of all politicians as these useless, evil, bad people. And actually, they're not all like that. And Gore had his failings, sure, but he did this. And not only has he helped raise awareness, sure, he doesn't talk about the solutions enough, but he's shown other political leaders that there is another life outside of politics where you can make a difference on the outside. And I think that's important in itself. Of course, film is an enormously influential medium, because it can reach far more people than we can with our books and our articles and our speeches. And I think that, again, is another lesson to activists, to not neglect that and focus more on other mediums to reach a far greater audience. My last point, really, I think, that I want to make is my job, most of the time, is to try to influence the British government on policy, on climate and energy and transport policy. I remember going into it thinking this is going to be impossible. I've spent my formative educational years with Jerry and others, David, around this table, telling me about the system. And the question from you with a hat implied, quite rightly, that it's, you know, this is really difficult. Of course it is, with a system controlled by corporations, the financial system as it is, the global institutions controlling things as they do. I was amazed to find that actually you can make a difference. Despite that, you can disrupt the system, you can introduce change to policy. The Labour government under Tony Blair was not a green government by any means, but they made significant advances. Blair was not an environmentalist when he came in, not at all, quite the opposite. He thought it was fringe, radical, a waste of space. But he is the government, his government was the one that introduced the most radical piece of legislation I've seen on climate change, a climate bill that puts in place a legally binding framework for the next 50 years to reduce carbon. It's legally binding. No one's done that. So I think we all should appreciate that we can make a difference at this time. No matter how difficult it is, we really can, and it's worth investing the effort to try to do that.
Very good. Good, Simon.
David? An important source of my sense of hope for possibility and my willingness to put forward audacious proposals comes from my experience. And of course, a key part of it is being part of exactly the process that Maud talked about, the development of the resistance against corporate globalization. And you know, we saw that emerge from a meeting of some 40 or 50 of us as the IFG, kind of the few people around the world that had been engaging and trying to understand what was going on and reinterpreting this thing about globalization as bringing democracy, prosperity, and freedom to the world into a new story that says, no, what it's really about is an attack on democracy and the basic rights of people and the environment. And as again, as Maud pointed out, we saw it move from that kind of kitchen table conversation among a few people to a global movement that has basically stymied that that corporate juggernaut supported by the most powerful people and institutions in the world, which is an amazing sign of the power of civil society. Now, some of my other experiences, back in 1992, I was one of the few voices standing up in an occasional public forum and saying, we need to close the World Bank. And people quite literally laugh at me. I mean, that's so incredible, impossible. And then I had the great joy of being here in this city in April 2000 mm-hmm. when 10,000 people were out on the street shouting, shut down the World Bank. And the Washington, D.C. police cooperated so beautifully, and they organized all these barricades, closed down the whole city in solidarity with the protesters, I assume. And so it made quite a mark. I mean, it got a lot of attention around the world. You know, when my book on Corporations Rule the World came out in 1995, it's kind of a turning point in my, you know, the book certainly didn't cause it, but I was very conscious that the timing of the book was absolutely perfect because it was a moment when people were starting to ask questions about what is this. You know, what are these outsized corporate salaries for the CEOs? What's going on about the outsourcing and the loss of jobs and these trade agreements and so forth? And it was a moment in which people were looking for frameworks and answers and beginning to challenge the issues. Well, it was just an opening to challenging the issues of corporate power. Now, I wanted to cite the statistics in terms of your question about, you know, people don't understand about corporations. I mean, there's a statistic from a poll published by Businessweek, that says, you know, 90% of people in the United States believe that big companies have too much power. Mm-hmm. Now, this, is, again, is a sign of enormous progress. Now, I hope you've all seen this issue of Yes Magazine laying mm-hmm. around all around the conference. Be sure to pick it up. Stand up to corporate power. Now, what this is about is we did this issue in cooperation with a coalition of organizations and individuals at the forefront of looking at corporate power issues, the Strategic Corporate Alliance, that is saying, you know, we've got all these movements against corporations, resistance against that corporation, this issue, that issue. What we really need to do is pull all this energy around to change the rules. And, I think we're now at a turning point in terms of beginning to organize a huge citizen movement around changing specific rules to start taking back this power that corporations have been aggregating under themselves for so many years. So these are, you know, we have to keep in perspective. It is so easy to get discouraged at any given moment and say nobody else sees the issue. And in fact, we often get that feeling even at a moment when most everybody does in fact see the issue. You know, I'm absolutely amazed. If you really, you know, we're so focused on the political divisions and the obvious evidence of political divisions in the United States. But if you look at the polling data from a different perspective, you begin to find these enormous areas of agreement and consensus. And this issue about corporate power is one of them. But others that are extraordinary to me, if you look poll after poll after poll, says as a country we are focused on the wrong priorities. Okay, well, different ideas of priorities. But if you look deeper, supermajorities on question after question of 80% and more want to see greater priority given to the needs of our children, our families, our communities, and our natural environment. Now, that is a basis for a huge political shift. And as others have suggested, we need to find the right language, we need to find the right stories to connect into different constituencies that look at those issues differently. But it all suggests to me that we do indeed have the foundation for a very powerful and constructive national conversation. And we all need to be participating in bringing that conversation forward.
The more that I learn about these issues, the more I realize the enormity of the task ahead of us. We're really talking about nothing less than reclaiming and transforming the political, the economic, and the cultural norms of society. But still, the more that I learn about it, the more hopeful I am. And I feel like we are at a cusp of a moment right now. And the data that David just said sort of reinforces that. I feel like more people are becoming dissatisfied with the work, watch, spend treadmill. More people are realizing at so many levels that it's just not working. On the planetary sustainability level, the evidence is all around us. On the equity, social justice level, the evidence is all around us, and we're not having that much fun. So on all of these levels, it's just not working, and more people are realizing that. At the same time, I think people are realizing that opting out of that work, watch, spend treadmill is not a burden and a hardship, but it's actually liberating. That eating local tastes better, that working less, you have a stronger community. We're not talking about hardship and sacrifice in a negative sense. We're talking about liberation and reclaiming what it means to really be human and live in a community. For those of us who have enough stuff, now I realize for many, many people in the world, they are still in a stage where they need more stuff. Is it half the world's population lives on less than $2 a day? There are vast segments of our planet where people need more stuff. And for them, there is a correlation between more stuff and more security and happiness. But once you get to a certain point, there's an inverse relationship. You have more stuff and you have more stress and less happiness. So I think that more and more people are getting disillusioned with all this crap we have all around us in life and are wanting to move to a higher quality of life, which means opting out of that work, watch, spend treadmill. I think we're going to have to make some major changes because of the planetary limits. And either we can resist them until the last minute and go kicking and screaming and have a miserable time, or we can start making those changes in a way where we have control over them, where we all together are deciding how to make them. And we will move towards greater planetary sustainability, greater social equity and justice, and we'll be a lot happier and have more fun.
Questions and answers on Dimensions of the Global Triple Crisis from the IFG Teach-In, Confronting the Global Triple Crisis, held last September in Washington, D.C. You can find this material and more at ifg.org. In our reading last week from Power and Powerlessness, author Susan Rosenthal addressed the question of what socioeconomic class is best able to act in the interests of humanity. Last week, we heard how it is not the ruling class, the capitalist class, which is in fact causing the problems. Despite having all the resources of society at its command, the ruling class is incapable of solving basic problems for two reasons: seize the surplus and compete or die. Because these two commandments rule society, she said, problems become important only when there is profit to be made or when a threat to profit must be averted. Nothing else matters. This results in environmental destruction and a descent into barbarism. Next, she analyzes the other two classes, beginning with the middle class. Could the middle class lead humanity to a better future? Middle-class professionals see themselves as natural leaders and advisors. They have more education than the average person and display a personal confidence that comes from commanding others. Some have influence with people in power or like to think they have. Professionals and student professionals often head movements for social justice. Unfortunately, the qualities that make a good professional are the opposite of those needed to challenge capitalism. The ruling class needs its managerial class to be loyal. If employers had to watch their managers the same way they watch workers, there would be no point in having managers. The professional is expected to carry out the boss's wishes when the boss isn't there. In other words, professionals must embrace the goals of their superiors as if they were their own. Professional schools are designed to ensure that graduates accept this social role, as I discovered in medical school. My first few months of medical school were very exciting. It was 1970, and our class was going to change the world. We named our student lounge after Norman Bethune and put up a poster of Che Guevara. Our heroes were doctors like Bethune, Che, Virchow, Sigarist, and Salvador Allende, who had just been elected president of Chile by a vibrant workers' movement. 3 years later, everything had changed. The economy was in recession. A U.S.-backed military coup had murdered Allende and crushed the Chilean workers' movement. If any of us were still rebels, we kept it to ourselves. One outspoken student was forced to repeat her year. A more stubborn one was turfed out. Another dropped out. In my last year of medical school, I got into trouble for telling a patient that she had almost died from a medical error. She had been given a medicine to which she was allergic, but the higher-ups decided not to tell her in order to avoid a lawsuit. I was concerned that if she ever had that medicine again, she would likely die, so I told her the truth. I had been taught and believed that the patient's welfare comes first. Silly me. The school convened a committee to decide if I should be allowed to graduate. Fortunately, a sympathetic professor interceded on my behalf, reassuring her colleagues that the problem was, quote, a lack of professional socialization, close quote, and that she would take care of it. Afterwards, she told me that I needed to learn to play the game. That was when I realized that medical school had two functions, to teach me the skills that I needed to work as a doctor, and more importantly, to ensure that I would be loyal to my superiors, regardless of the needs of my patients. Hospital training provided the perfect brainwashing conditions and the final testing ground for medical graduates. We were run off our feet, deprived of sleep and food, dominated, interrogated, humiliated, and confined to the building for days at a time. Our heads were stuffed with facts. We were taught to give the, quote, right answers. We were expected to question, but not to question, our superiors. We did as they said, even when we thought they were wrong. We learned to cover their butts and our own. At graduation, my formerly diverse class looked and talked the same. Somewhere along the way, we had traded our dreams of social change for money and status. We were the successful products of the professional training system. Dreams for Sale. In Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives, Jeff Schmidt explains that most students enter professional schools with a dream of making the world a better place. By the end of their training, quote, deep down, something has changed. Students who once spoke critically of the system are careful not to be provocative, not to do or say anything that might displease individuals in authority. Any opposition is now sufficiently abstract and theoretical not to be provocative, close quote. Whether they are physicists, journalists, doctors, political scientists, psychologists, or engineers, the professional is trained to be an obedient thinker, an intellectual property whom employers can trust to experiment, theorize, innovate, and create safely within the confines of an assigned ideology. Those who question the social context of their work, are accused of having a political agenda. Those who keep their heads down are promoted. Professionals are expected to uphold class divisions and social hierarchies. For members of oppressed groups, the price of admission to the professional class is the willingness to discriminate against members of your own group or go along with that discrimination. The racist, sexist, and homophobic attitudes that pervade professional schools pressure minority, female, and gay students to swallow their dignity and to pressure their fellows to do the same. This happens in medical schools as well as police academies. Only 3% of physicians in the United States are black. Despite their own experience of racism in the medical profession, studies show that black physicians are just as likely as white physicians to discriminate against black patients. A study of 4,000 Medicare patients found that white patients were significantly more likely than black patients to receive a preferred treatment for heart attack, regardless of whether the physician was black or white. What would account for such a finding? Students who apply to professional schools are put through a rigorous selection and training process designed to exclude those who challenge the status quo. Black students who want to become doctors must put loyalty to the profession first. Those who challenge racist practices are pushed out. The successful graduate is a middle-class professional who is willing to ration medical care on the basis of race, class, and gender, or who goes along with that rationing. Breaking ranks. Professionals are squeezed between the demands of their employers and the needs of those they manage. As a result, managers who lack professional training can be pulled apart. One of my patients found herself in this dilemma when she was promoted to supervisor. Janice was under pressure from the boss to increase production, but she didn't want her former co-workers to dislike her. There was no way to please both sides. The stress mounted, and she became too sick to work. Professional training is designed to prevent such outcomes by ensuring professional loyalty to the employer. As added insurance, employers prefer to hire professionally trained staff from outside the company, putting another barrier in the way of people working their way up. Despite their rigorous training, some professionals will break ranks and switch sides. Whoever warned against the fury of a woman scorned has never felt the wrath of an employer betrayed. After Disciplined Minds was published, Schmidt was fired from his 19-year position as editor of Physics Today. In 1971, military analyst Daniel Ellsberg decided that his first duty was to the public, so he sent confidential government documents to the New York Times. The Pentagon Papers exposed the lies that Washington was telling about the war in Vietnam and helped to turn the public against the administration and against the war. Ellsberg was charged with theft, conspiracy, and espionage. However, all charges were dropped when it was revealed that one group of federal agents had broken into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office to steal information to use against him, and another group of agents had been assigned to kill him. Assassinating Ellsberg would have sent a powerful message to other government employees not to switch sides. Rachel Carson was a whistleblower who worked as a marine biologist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Her 1962 classic, Silent Spring, documented the damaging environmental impact of DDT and other pesticides. To discredit Carson, the chemical industry threatened any publisher or publication that promoted her findings. She was labeled a, quote, spinster communist, a lesbian, and a scientific amateur, close quote. To counter Carson's, quote, distorted account, the American Medical Association referred doctors with questions about pesticides to the chemical industries who produced them. In Fast Food Nation, Eric Schlosser describes the smear campaign against his exposé of the fast food industry. Despite his meticulous research, Schlosser was denounced as a dunce and an economics ignoramus. His logical conclusions were dismissed as a hodgepodge of impressions, statistics, anecdotes, and prejudices, and he was condemned as a health fascist. When Barbara Ehrenreich described the conditions of America's working poor in Nickel and Dimed, her book was condemned as a classic Marxist rant and a work of intellectual pornography with no redeeming characteristics. Ehrenreich herself was lambasted as an antichrist and a dedicated enemy of the American family for arguing that families headed by single women deserve the same social support as families headed by married couples. When professionals criticize the system, they step over the line that capitalism warns them not to cross. As a result, most books that critique society deliver toothless endings. A good example is The Politics of Cancer, in which Samuel Epstein documents the harm caused by industrial pollution, concluding, quote, "We must be willing to accept the fundamental reality that a significant reduction to exposure to environmental carcinogens will result only from organized political action," close quote. He then does an abrupt turn and offers 16 pages of suggestions on how individuals can reduce their risk of getting cancer. Among other things, he advises, quote, "If you can possibly avoid it, do not live close to a chemical plant, refinery, asbestos plant, or metal mining, processing, or smelting plant, or hazardous waste disposal site, even if it claims to be well managed. Also avoid living close to major highways and expressways," close quote. People do not choose to live in polluted industrial areas. They do so because they cannot afford to live anywhere else. Epstein's suggestions blame the victim for getting in the way of capitalist pollution. He also warns, quote, "Unless you are fully and completely prepared to take the consequences, you should not go to work in an uncontrolled, high-risk industry, especially one with a bad track record," close quote. In reality, people are forced to work at dangerous jobs in order to feed their families. Try telling the families of the dead Sago miners that their loved ones should have worked somewhere else. Regardless of how thoroughly professionals document the insanity of capitalism, an invisible barrier prevents them from rejecting the system altogether. When the next logical step will take them over that line, there is intense pressure to back off and propose solutions that, according to their own analysis, cannot work. I could not understand this phenomenon until I found myself balking at crossing that line and risking my own middle-class privileges by writing this book. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal. Damage control. When social conditions deteriorate to the point that whole sections of the middle class threaten to revolt, higher-level managers ensure that lower-level managers remain loyal, as this Canadian example reveals. Underfunded medical services stress patients and the professionals who treat them. By 1998, 62% of Canadian physicians reported that their workload was too heavy, and more than half said that their family and personal life were suffering. By 2003, 46% of doctors were in an advanced phase of burnout, that is, the feeling that they are ineffective, emotionally overrun, and exhausted by their work, and showing clear signs of depersonalization in relationships, close quote. The Canadian Medical Association, CMA, attributed these problems to higher workloads, inadequate resources, and loss of control over how medical care is provided, warning that the healthcare system and those of us who work in it have been seriously traumatized. The CMA pleaded for more funds for the medical system. When moral persuasion proved ineffective, the CMA did not fight for more funding. That would have been unprofessional. Instead, the CMA did an about turn to provide damage control for the system. The president of the CMA stated, quote, "Occupational stress and burnout have become facts of life, and physicians owe it to ourselves and our families to look after our own health," close quote. The CMA launched a national program to help doctors cope with stressful working conditions and requested government fund research to answer questions like, quote, why does one physician burn out while his colleagues cope well, close quote. Similar pressures in the United States caused the Joint Committee for the Accreditation of Health Organizations to set new standards requiring hospitals to identify and manage matters of individual physician health. Doctors were advised that the key to managing stress is, quote, putting yourself first, staying healthy, and paying prompt attention to illness. If you do that, no one gets impaired, close quote. In Britain, psychologists study the learning style of doctors to identify which ones are more likely to burn out at work. None of these measures solve the problem of too few people being expected to do too much work. Because professionals are trained not to question the system, the professional response to social problems has a predictable pattern. The problem is identified and sincere concern is expressed. Along with a genuine desire to help, the healthcare system and those of us who work in it have been seriously traumatized. When moral pressure fails to affect change, the professional switches stride. The status quo is accepted. Occupational stress and burnout have become facts of life, and the problem is redefined. Those being victimized are expected to adjust to the new reality. Putting yourself first, staying healthy, and paying prompt attention to illness. Those who succumb to stressful conditions are blamed. Those who follow recommendations will not become impaired. And finally, an appeal for help is made to the source of the problem, requesting government-funded research to address the symptoms of a government-created crisis. More funds could be obtained for the medical system by organizing a united front composed of all medical workers, doctors, nurses, technicians, orderlies, cleaners, kitchen staff, clerical workers, patients and their families, in short, a class fight. Regardless of how effective such a strategy would be, proposals for united action are dismissed as unprofessional. Professionals are programmed to uphold social divisions, not to break them down. The working class. A dozen CEOs are meeting and the light goes out. It's not their problem, and they find another room. A dozen professionals are meeting, and the light goes out. They wait for someone to come from maintenance. They discuss the importance of light and how frustrating it is not to have it. A dozen workers are meeting, and the light goes out. They fix the light. The working class is the only class that society cannot do without. Workers make everything possible. Jane drives the bus. Jorge removes garbage, Maria constructs furniture, and Mike installs plumbing. Without their daily efforts, the world would grind to a halt. Capitalism created the working class. Before capitalism, most people were farmers. The capitalist revolution forced peasants off the land and into factories. Now the working class is the majority of humanity. By demanding higher productivity, capitalism has forced the working class to produce enough surplus to end human deprivation. Finally, the spread of capitalism throughout the world has created an international working class. These three characteristics make the interests of the working class identical with the interests of humanity. The majority. Workers are not only the majority class in terms of numbers, they are the most organized class. Regardless of where they were born, the color of their skin, what language they speak, who they vote for, what church they attend or don't attend, their age, sex, and sexual orientation, workers do all of the socially necessary work in society, and they do it together. Despite the divisions and competition imposed by capitalism, cooperation is essential to the workers' daily experience. On the assembly line of a car factory, or a fast food restaurant, workers must cooperate to create the finished product. Workers must also cooperate to defend themselves against the employer's demands. This necessity for cooperation has produced the working class slogans, "An injury to one is an injury to all," and "United we stand, divided we fall." These principles fit the needs of humanity equally well. As the organized majority, the working class offers the best hope for humanity to liberate itself from capitalism. The producing class. We live in a world shaped by human labor. Goods, services, money, capital. All represent units of human labor. Under capitalism, the working class does not produce for itself, but for the capitalist class. The capitalist forces the worker to exchange the collective power to produce for the individual, quote, power to consume. However, the real power of workers lies not in their wallets, but in their ability to stop producing for profit and to start producing for need. When the working class produces to meet its own needs, it also produces to meet humanity's needs, because the two are indistinguishable. By taking collective control of production, the working class could end class divisions and unite humanity in the common project of managing society. The international class. The international working class already runs the world for capitalism. Computers are manufactured by Chinese workers, assembled by Mexican workers, sold by American workers, and serviced by Indian workers. The working class is international. Every major city contains workers from many different nations. Youngsters around the world watch the same movies, listen to the same music, eat the same fast food, and wear the same clothes. However, the persistence of national borders prevents the global integration of humanity. By organizing across national borders, the working class could put an end to war and raise everyone's living standards. Unlike the capitalist class and the middle class, the working class has no interests that conflict with the interests of humanity as a whole. The greatest obstacle to majority rule is the belief that it would never work. Fortunately, beliefs can change. The next chapter explores how the working class could take control of society. Summary. Class divisions block humanity from solving pressing problems. The ruling class' obsession with profit endangers human survival. The middle class lacks the power to challenge the ruling class. Only the working class has the size, the organization, and the ability to free humanity from capitalism. And that's the conclusion of Chapter 13, Decide Which Side You're On, From Power and Powerlessness, by Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. Next week, we'll continue with the next chapter. In the meantime, if you would like to get a hold of the entire book in various forms, you can do so by going to the author's website at susanrosenthal.com. I will be interviewing Dr. Rosenthal at the conclusion of the serial reading of her book. If you would like me to put questions or comments to her on your behalf, and I encourage you to do so, please send them to me through the email link at the Unwelcome Guests website at unwelcomeguests.org, where MP3s and podcasts of this and all previous episodes of the show are available. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Happy holidays and happy New Year.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always